The men at the table included both Jardine and Matheson employees and a number of representatives from other shipping companies. Magnac & Co., J. Scott & Co., and others whose names Robin promptly forgot. They were all white men, who seemed cut from precisely the same cloth as Mr. Bayliss. Superficially charming and talkative men who, despite their clean-cut attire, seemed to exude an air of intangible dirtiness. Apart from businessmen, there was Reverend Karl Gutzlaff, a German-born missionary who apparently did more interpreting for the shipping companies than conversion of Chinese souls. Reverend Gutzlaff proudly informed them that he was also a member of the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge in China, and was currently writing a series of articles for a Chinese language magazine to teach the Chinese about the difficult Western concept of free trade.
This society, founded in November 1834, was created with the goal of inducing the Qing Empire to become more open to Western traders and missionaries through deploying intellectual artillery. It was inspired by the London Society, which generously elevated the poor and dissuaded political radicalism through the gift of education.
"We're delighted to have you working with us," said Mr. Bayliss to Robin as the first course, a bland, gingery soup, was served. "It's so hard to find good Chinese translators that can string together a full sentence in English. The Western-trained ones are much better. You'll be interpreting for me during my audience with the commissioner on Thursday."
"I am?" Robin was startled. "Why me?" This was a fair question, he thought. He'd never interpreted professionally before, and it seemed odd to choose him for an audience with the greatest authority in Canton. "Why not Reverend Gutzlaff or Professor Lovell?"
"Because we are Caucasian men," Professor Lovell said wryly, "and therefore barbarians."
"And they won't speak to barbarians, of course," said Mr. Bayliss.
"Card looks rather Chinese, though," said Professor Lovell. "Aren't they still convinced you're at least part Oriental?"
"Only when I introduce myself as I Han Zhe," said Reverend Gutzlaff.
Reverend Gutzlaff indeed often went by the name I Han Zhe, which translates as one who loves the Chinese. This moniker was not ironic. Gutzlaff really did see himself as the champion of the Chinese people, whom he referred to in correspondence as kind, friendly, open, and intellectually curious people, who unfortunately happened to be under the thraldom of Satan. That he could reconcile this attitude with his support for the opium trade remains an interesting contradiction.
"Though I think Commissioner Lin will not be too enamoured with the title."
The company men all chuckled, though Robin couldn't see what was so funny. A certain smugness underwrote this entire exchange, an air of brotherly fraternity, of shared access to some long-running joke the rest of them didn't understand. It reminded Robin of Professor Lovell's gatherings in Hampstead, as he'd never been able to tell what the joke was back then either, or what the men had to be so satisfied about. No one was drinking much of their soup. Servants cleared their bowls away and replaced them with both the main course and dessert at once. The main course was potatoes with some sort of grey sauce-covered lump, either beef or pork, Robin couldn't tell. Dessert was even more mysterious, a violently orange thing that looked a bit like a sponge.
"What's this?"
Remy asked, prodding his dessert. Victoire sliced off a piece with her fork and examined it.
"It's sticky toffee pudding, I think."
"It's orange," said Robin.
"It's burnt,"
Letty licked her thumb.
"And it's made with carrots, I think."
The other guests were chuckling again.
"The kitchen staff are all chinks," explained Mr. Bayliss. "They've never been to England. We keep describing the foods we'd like, and of course they have no idea how it tastes or how to make it, but it's still funny to see them try. Afternoon tea is better. They understand the point of sweet treats, and we've got our own English cows here to supply the milk."
"I don't understand," said Robin. "Why don't you just have them cook Cantonese dishes?"
"Because English cuisine reminds one of home," said Reverend Gutzlaff. "One appreciates such creature comforts on faraway journeys."
"But it tastes like rubbish," said Rami.
And nothing could be more English, said Reverend Gutzlaff, cutting vigorously into his grey meat.
Anyhow, said Mr. Bayliss, the commissioner is going to be devilishly difficult to work with. Rumours are he's very strict, extremely uptight. He thinks Canton is a cesspool of corruption, and that all Western traders and nefarious villains intend on swindling his government.
Astute one, that, said Reverend Gutzlaff to more self-satisfied chuckles.
I do prefer when they underestimate us, Mr. Bayliss agreed. Now, Robin Swift, the issue at hand is the opium bond, which would make all foreign ships assume responsibility before Chinese law for any opium they may smuggle in. It used to be that this ban existed on paper only. We dock our ships at, how shall we call them, outer anchorages? Like Lin Tin and Kemsing Moon and such, where we distribute cargo for resale with local partners. But that's all changed under Commissioner Lin. His arrival, as I've told you, was quite the shake-up. Captain Elliot, good man, but he's a coward where it matters, defused the situation by letting them confiscate all the opium we had in our possession. Here, Mr. Baelish clutched his chest as if physically pained.
Over 20,000 chests! Do you know how much that's worth? Nearly £2.5 million. That's unjust seizure of British property, I tell you. Surely that's grounds for war. Captain Elliot thinks he saved us from starvation and violence, but he's only shown the Chinese that they can walk all over us.
Mr. Bayliss pointed his fork at Robin.
So that's what we'll need you for. Richard's caught you up on what we want in this round of negotiations, yes?
I've read through the proposal drafts, Robin said, but I'm a bit confused on the priorities.
Yes?
Well, it seems the ultimatum on opium is a bit extreme, said Robin. I don't see why you couldn't break it into some more piecemeal deals. I mean, certainly you could still negotiate on all the other exports.
There are no other exports, said Mr. Bayliss. None that matter.
It just seems that the Chinese have a rather good point, Robin said, helplessly, given it's such a harmful drug.
Don't be ridiculous.
Mr. Bayliss smiled a wide, practiced smile.
Smoking opium is the safest and most gentlemanlike speculation I am aware of.
This was such an obvious lie that Robin blinked at him, astounded.
The Chinese memorandums call it one of the greatest vices ever to plague their country.
Oh, opium's not as harmful as all that, said Reverend Gutzlaff. Indeed, it's prescribed as laudanum in Britain all the time. Little old ladies regularly use it to go to sleep. It's no more a vice than tobacco or brandy. I often recommend it to members of my congregation.
But isn't pipe opium a great deal stronger? Rami cut in. It really doesn't seem like sleep aids are the issue here.
That's missing the point, said Mr. Bayliss with a touch of impatience. The point is free trade between nations. We're all liberals, aren't we? There should be no restrictions between those who have goods and those who want to purchase them. That's justice.
A curious defence, said Rami, to justify a vice with virtue.
Mr. Bayliss scoffed.
Oh, the Qing Emperor doesn't care about vices. He's stingy about his silver, that's all. But trade only works when there's give and take, and currently we're sitting at a deficit. There's nothing we have that those Chinamen want, apparently, except opium. They can't get enough of the stuff. They'll pay anything for it. And if I had my way, every man, woman, and child in this country would be puffing opium smoke until they couldn't think straight.
He concluded by slamming his hand against the table. The noise was perhaps louder than he intended. It cracked like a gunshot. Victoire and Letty flinched back. Rami looked too amazed to reply.
But that's cruel, said Robin. That's terribly cruel.
It's their free choice, isn't it? Mr. Bayliss said. You can't form business. Chinamen are simply filthy, lazy, and easily addicted. And you certainly can't blame England for the foibles of an inferior race. Not when there's money to be made.
Mr. Bayliss?
Robin's fingers tingled with a strange and urgent energy. He didn't know whether he wanted to bolt or to hit the man.
Mr. Bayliss, I'm a Chinaman.
Mr. Bayliss, for once, fell silent. His eyes roved over Robin's face, as if trying to detect the truth of this statement in his features. Then, to Robin's great surprise, he burst out laughing.
No, you're not!
He leaned back and clasped his hands over his chest, still guffawing.
Good Lord, that's hilarious! No, you're not!
Professor Lovell said nothing. Translation work began promptly the next day. Good linguists were always in heavy demand at Canton, and were pulled in a dozen different directions whenever they did show up. Western traders did not like using the government-licensed native Chinese linguists because their language skills were so often subpar.
Forget English, complained Mr. Bayliss to Professor Lovell. Half of them aren't even fluent in Mandarin. And you can't trust them to represent your interests besides. You can always tell when they're not giving you the truth. I once had a man lie to my face about the customs rates when the Arabic numerals were right there.
The trading companies occasionally employed Westerners fluent in Chinese, but they were hard to find. Officially, teaching Chinese to a foreigner was a crime punishable by death. Now, as China's borders were slightly more porous, this law was impossible to enforce, but it did mean skilled translators were often missionaries like Reverend Gutzlaff with little spare time. The upshot was that people like Robin and Professor Lovell were worth their weight in gold. Rami, Letty, and Victoire, poor things, would be shuttled from factory to factory all day doing silverwork maintenance. But Robin and Professor Lovell's itineraries were crammed with meetings starting from 8 a.m. Promptly after breakfast, Robin accompanied Mr. Bayliss to the harbour to go over shipping manifests with Chinese customs officials. The customs office had supplied their own translator, a reedy, bespectacled man named Meng, who uttered each English word with slow, timid deliberateness, as if terrified of mispronouncing anything.
"We will now go over the inventory," he told Robin. His deferential, upwards-trailing tone made it sound as if he were asking a question.
Robin could not tell if he was asking him for permission or not.
Yes,
he cleared his throat, then enunciated in his best Mandarin, "Proceed." Meng began reading off the inventory list, glancing up after every item so that Mr. Bayliss could confirm in which boxes those goods had been stored.
125 pounds copper, 78 pounds ginseng crude, 24 boxes beetle...
Beetle nuts, corrected Mr. Bayliss.
Betel?
You know, beetle, said Mr. Bayliss. Or areca nuts, if you will, for chewing.
He pointed to his jaw and mimed the act.
No?
Meng, still baffled, looked to Robin for help. Robin swiftly translated into Chinese, and Meng nodded.
Beetle nuts.
Oh, enough of this, snapped Mr. Bayliss. Let Robin do it. You can translate the whole list, can't you, Robin? It would save us a good deal of time. They're hopeless, I told you. All of them. A whole country and not a single competent English speaker among them.
Meng seemed to understand this perfectly. He cast Robin a scathing look, and Robin bent his head over the manifest to avoid his eye. It went on like this all morning. Mr. Bayliss met with a procession of Chinese agents, all of whom he treated with incredible rudeness, and then looked to Robin as if expecting him to translate not only his words, but his utter contempt for his interlocutors. By the time they adjourned for lunch, Robin had developed a painful, throbbing headache. He could not take another moment of Mr. Bayliss's company. Even supper, which was served back in the English factory, was no respite. Mr. Bayliss spent the whole time recounting silly claims the customs officials had made, and kept casting his stories in a way that made Robin sound like he'd verbally slapped the Chinese at every turn. Rami, Victoire, and Letty looked very confused. Robin scarcely spoke. He scarfed down his food, this time a more tolerable, if flavourless, dish of beef over rice, and then announced that he was heading back out.
"Where are you going?"
asked Mr. Bayliss.
"I want to go and see the city." Robin's irritation made him bold.
We're done for the day, aren't we?
Foreigners aren't allowed in this city, said Mr. Bayliss.
I'm not a foreigner. I was born here. Mr. Bayliss had no rejoinder.
Robin took his silence as assent. He snatched up his coat and strode towards the door. Rami hurried after him.
Suppose I come with you?
Please, Robin almost said, but hesitated. I'm not sure if you can.
Robin saw Victoire and Letty glancing their way. Letty made as if to rise, but Victoire put an arm on her shoulder.
I'll be fine, said Rami, pulling on his coat. I'll be with you.
They walked out the front door and down the length of the 13 factories. When they crossed from the foreign enclave into the Cantonese suburbs, no one stopped them. No one seized them by the arm and insisted they return to where they belonged. Even Rami's face attracted no peculiar comment. Indian Lascars were a common sight in Canton, and they attracted less attention than white foreigners. It was, strangely, a complete reversal of their situation in England. Robin led them through the streets of downtown Canton at random. He didn't know what he was looking for. Childhood haunts? Familiar landmarks? He had no destination in mind, no place he thought would bring catharsis. All he felt was a deep urgency, a need to walk over as much territory as he could before the sun went down.
Does it feel like home? Rami asked, lightly, neutrally, as if tiptoeing on eggshells.
Not in the least, Robin said.
He felt so deeply confused.
I'm not sure what this is.
Canton was wildly different from the way he'd left it. The construction on the docks, which had been going on since Robin could remember, had exploded into entire complexes of new buildings, warehouses, company offices, inns, restaurants, and tea houses. But what else had he expected? Canton had always been a shifting, dynamic city, sucking in what the sea delivered and digesting it all into its own peculiar hybridity. How could he ever assume it might remain rooted in the past? Still, this transformation felt like a betrayal. It felt like the city had closed off any possible path home.
Where did you used to live?
Rami asked, still in that careful, gentle tone, as if Robin were a basket of emotions threatening to spill.
One of the shanty towns. Robin looked around. Not too far from here, I think.
Do you want to go?
Robin thought of that dry, stuffy house, the stink of diarrhea and decomposing bodies. It was the last place in the world he wanted to visit again. But it seemed even worse not to have a look.
I'm not sure I can find it, but we can try.
Eventually, Robin found his way back to his old home, not by following the streets, which had now become wholly unfamiliar, but by walking until the distance between the docks, the river, and the setting sun felt familiar. Yes, this was where home should have been. He remembered the curve of the riverfront, as well as the rickshaw lot on the opposite bank.
Is this it?
Asked Rami.
It's all shops.
The street didn't resemble anything he remembered. His family house had disappeared off the face of the planet. He couldn't even tell where its foundations lay. They could have been beneath the tea shop in front of them, or the company office to its left, or the lavishly ornamented shop near the end of the street with a sign that read, in garish red paint, Hua Yan Guan, Flower Smoke Shop, an opium den. Robin strode towards it.
Where are you going? Rami hurried behind him. What's that?
It's where all the opium goes. They come here to smoke it.
Robin felt a sudden unbearable curiosity. His gaze darted around the shopfront, trying to memorize every detail of it. The large paper lanterns, the lacquered exterior, the girls in face paint and long skirts beckoning from the shop front. They beamed at him, extending their arms like dancers as he approached.
Hello, mister, they cooed in Cantonese. Won't you come in for some fun?
Good heavens, said Rami. Come away from there.
One moment. Robin felt compelled by some fierce, twisted desire to know.
The same vicious urge that compelled one to prod at a sore, just to see how badly it could hurt.
I just want to have a look around, Inside, the smell hit him like a wall. It was cloying, sickly, and sugar sweet, both repulsive and enticing at once. "Welcome, sir."
A hostess materialized around Robin's arm. She smiled wide as she took in his expression.
"Is this your first time?"
"I don't..." Suddenly, the words failed Robin. He could understand Cantonese, but he couldn't speak it.
"Would you like to try?"
The hostess held out a pipe towards him. It was already lit. The pot glowed with gently burning opium, and a small trickle of smoke unfurled from the tip.
"You're first on the house, mister."
"What's she saying?" Remy asked.
"Birdie, don't touch that."
"Look how much fun they're having."
The hostess gestured around the sitting room.
"Won't you have a taste?"
The den was filled with men. Robin hadn't noticed them before. It was so dark. But now he saw that there were at least a dozen opium smokers sprawled over low couches in various states of undress. Some fondled girls perched atop their laps. Some listlessly played a gambling game. And some lay alone in a stupor, mouths half open and eyes half closed, staring out at nothing.
Your uncle couldn't stay away from those dens.
The sight prompted words he hadn't recalled in a decade. Words in his mother's voice. Words she'd sighed throughout his childhood.
"We used to be rich, darling. Look at us now."
He thought of his mother reminiscing bitterly about the gardens she used to tend and the dresses she used to wear before his uncle frittered their family fortune away in an opium den like this. He imagined his mother, young and desperate, eager to do anything for the foreign man who promised her coin, who used and abused her and left her with an English maid and a bewildering set of instructions to raise their child, her child, in a language she couldn't speak herself. Robin was birthed by choices produced from poverty. Poverty produced from this.
"A draft, mister?"
Before he registered what he was doing, the pipe was in his mouth. He was breathing in. The hostess was smiling wider, saying something he didn't understand. And everything was sweet and dizzy and lovely and awful all at once. He coughed, then sucked in hard again. He had to see how addictive this stuff was, if it really could make one sacrifice all else.
"Fine," Remy gripped his arm. "That's enough. Let's go."
They walked briskly back through the city, this time with Remy in the lead. Robin didn't speak a word. He couldn't tell how much those few drafts of opium had affected him, whether he was only imagining his symptoms. Once, out of curiosity, he had thumbed through a copy of De Quincey's Confessions of an English Opium Eater, which described the effect of opium as communicating serenity and equipoise to all the faculties, of greatly invigorating one's self-possession, and of giving an expansion to the heart. But he felt none of those things. The only words he would use to describe himself now were not quite right. He felt vaguely nauseated. His head swam, his heart beat too fast, and his body moved far too slowly.
"You all right?" Remy asked after a while.
"I'm drowning,"
Robin mumbled.
"No, you're not," said Remy. "You're only being hysterical. We'll get back to the factories and you'll drink a nice tall glass of water."
"It's called Yang Huo," said Robin.
"Yang Huo."
"That's what she called the opium. Yang means foreign. Huo means goods. Yang Huo means foreign goods. That's how they refer to everything here. Young people. Young guilds. Yang Huo. An obsession with foreign goods. With opium. And that's me. That's coming from me. I'm young."
They paused over a bridge, beneath which fishermen and sampans went back and forth. The din of it, the cacophony of a language she'd spent so much time away from and now had to focus on to decipher, made Robin want to press his hands against his ears to block out a soundscape that should have, but did not, feel like home.
"I'm sorry I didn't tell you," he said. "About Hermes."
Remy sighed.
Birdie, not now. I should have told you, Robin insisted. I should have, and I didn't, because somehow I still had it all split in my head, and I never put the two pieces together because I just didn't see. I don't know how I didn't see. Rami regarded him in silence for a long moment, and then stepped closer so that they were standing side by side, gazing out over the water. You know, he said quietly, Sir Horace Wilson, my guardian, once took me to one of the opium fields he'd invested in West Bengal. I don't think I ever told you about it. That's where the bulk of this stuff is grown.
In Bengal,
Bihar, and Patna. Sir Horace owned a share in one of the plantations. He was so proud. He thought this was the future of the colonial trade. He made me shake hands with his field workers. He told them that someday I might be their supervisor. This stuff changed everything, he said. This corrected the trade deficit. I don't think I'll ever forget what I saw. He rested his elbows against the bridge and sighed. Rows and rows of flowers. A whole ocean of them. They're such bright scarlet that the fields look wrong, like the land itself is bleeding. It's all grown in the countryside. Then it gets packed and transported to Calcutta, where it's handed off to private merchants who bring it straight here. The two most popular opium brands here are called Patna and Malwa. Both regions in India. From my home straight to yours, Birdie. Isn't that funny? Rami glanced sideways at him. The British are turning my homeland into a narco-military state to pump drugs into yours. That's how this empire connects us. Robin saw a great spider's web in his mind then. Cotton from India to Britain, opium from India to China, silver becoming tea and porcelain in China, and everything flowing back to Britain. It sounded so abstract, just categories of use, exchange, and value, until it wasn't. Until you realized the web you lived in and the exploitations your lifestyle demanded. Until you saw looming above it all the specter of colonial labor and colonial pain. It's sick, he whispered. It's sick. It's so sick. But it's just trade, said Rami. Everyone benefits. Everyone profits. Even if it's only one country that profits a good deal more. Continuous gains. That's the logic, isn't it? So why would we ever try to break out? The point is, Birdie, I think I understand why you didn't see. Almost no one does. Free trade. This was always the British line of argument. Free trade, free competition, an equal playing field for all. Only it never ended up that way, did it? What free trade really meant was British imperial dominance. For what was free about a trade that relied on a massive build-up of naval power to secure maritime access? When mere trading companies could wage war, assess taxes, and administer civil and criminal justice? Griffin was right to be angry, thought Robin, but he was wrong to think he could do anything about it. These trade networks were carved in stone. Nothing was pushing this arrangement off its course. There were too many private interests, too much money at stake. They could see where it was going, but the people who had the power to do anything about it had been placed in positions where they would profit, and the people who suffered most had no power at all. It was so easy to forget, he said. The cards it's built on, I mean. Because when you're at Oxford, in the Tower, they're just words, just ideas. But the world's so much bigger than I thought.
It's just as big as we thought, Rami said. It's just that we forgot the rest of it mattered. We got so good at refusing to see what was right in front of us.
But now I've seen it, said Robin. Or at least understand it a bit better. And it's tearing me apart, Rami. And I don't even understand why. It's not as if...
As if what?
As if he'd seen anything properly horrible. As if he'd seen the slave plantations in the West Indies at the height of their cruelty, or the starved bodies in India, victims of utterly avoidable famines, or the slaughtered natives of the New World. All he'd seen was one opium den. But that was enough to act as a synecdoche for the awful, undeniable rest. He leaned over the side of the bridge, wondering how it might feel if he just toppled over the edge.
Are you going to jump, Birdie?
Rami asked.
It just doesn't feel...
Robin took a deep breath.
It doesn't feel like we have the right to be alive.
Rami sounded very calm. Do you mean that?
No, I don't. I just...
Robin squeezed his eyes shut. His thoughts were so jumbled. He had no idea how to convey what he meant. And all he could grasp at were memories, passing references.
Did you ever read Gulliver's Travels?
I read it all the time when I lived here. I read it so often I nearly memorized it. And there's this chapter where Gulliver winds up on a land ruled by horses, who call themselves the Houyhnhnms, and where the humans are savage, idiot slaves called Yahoos. They're swapped, and Gulliver gets so used to living with his Houyhnhnm master, gets so convinced of Houyhnhnm superiority, that when he gets home, he's horrified by his fellow humans. He thinks they're imbeciles. He can't stand to be around them. And that's how this... That's... Robin rocked back and forth over the bridge. He felt like no matter how hard he breathed, he could not get enough air.
Do you know what I mean?
I do, Rami said gently. But it does no one any good for us to get into histrionics about it. So step down, Birdie, and let's go and have that glass of water. The next morning, Robin accompanied Mr. Bayliss to the downtown government office for their audience with Imperial High Commissioner Lin Zhezu.
This Lin fellow is smarter than the rest, said Mr. Bayliss as they walked. Nigh incorruptible. In the southeast, they call him Lin Qingtian.
Qingtian?
Qing, meaning clear. Tian, meaning the skies or heavens.
Clear as the heavens. He's so impervious to bribes.
Robin said nothing. He had decided to suffer through the rest of his duties in Canton by doing the bare minimum required of him. And this did not involve egging on Mr. Bayliss's racist diatribes. Mr. Bayliss did not appear to notice.
Now be on your toes. The Chinese are a devilishly tricky sort, duplicitous by nature and all that. Always saying one thing when they mean quite the opposite. Careful you don't let them get the better of you.
I'll stay sharp, Robin said shortly. By Mr. Bayliss's account, one would imagine Commissioner Lin was 9 foot tall, had eyes that could shoot fire and trickster's horns. In person, the commissioner was a mild-mannered, gentle-featured man of average height and build. His person was entirely nondescript save for his eyes, which seemed unusually bright and perceptive. He had with him his own interpreter, a young Chinese man who introduced himself as William Botello, and who, to Robin's surprise, had studied English in the United States.
Welcome, Mr. Bayliss, said Commissioner Lin, as William swiftly translated into English. I'm told you have some thoughts you would like to share with me.
The issue, as you know, is the opium trade, said Mr. Bayliss. It is the opinion of Mr. Jardine and Mr. Matheson that it would benefit both your people and ours if their agents could legally sell opium along the coast in Canton without interference. They'd appreciate an official apology for the inhospitable treatment their trading agents received earlier this year. And it seems only just that the 20,000 chests of opium that were seized a few months ago are returned to us, or at least monetary compensation equivalent to their market value.
For the first few moments, Commissioner Lin only listened, blinking as Robin continued to rattle off Mr. Bayliss's list of demands. Robin tried not to convey Mr. Bayliss's tone, which was loud and patronizing, but to instead deliver them in as flat and emotionless a manner as he could manage. Still, his ears reddened in embarrassment. This did not feel like a dialogue, but a lecture, the sort one might give a dim child. Mr. Bayliss did not seem baffled by Commissioner Lin's lack of response. When his words met with silence, he merely continued.
Mr. Jardine and Matheson would also like to say that the Qing Emperor ought to realize his government's exclusive trade policies do not benefit the Chinese. Your own people, in fact, resent your trade barriers, which they believe do not represent their interests. They would much rather enjoy free association with foreigners, for that gives them, too, an opportunity to seek wealth. Free trade is, after all, the secret to national prosperity, and believe me, your people could do with reading some Adam Smith.
Finally, Commissioner Lin spoke.
We know this. William Botello swiftly translated.
It was an odd conversation, conveyed through four people, none of whom spoke directly to the person he was listening to. These are the precise terms in the many letters delivered from Mr. Jardine and Matheson, no? Have you come to say anything new?
Robin looked expectantly to Mr. Bayliss. Mr. Bayliss faltered briefly.
Well, no, but it bears repeating in person.
Commissioner Lin clasped his hands behind his back, then asked, Mr. Bayliss, is it not true that in your own country, opium is prohibited with the utmost strictness and severity? He paused to let William translate.
Well, yes,
said Mr. Bayliss.
But the question is trade, not Britain's domestic restrictions.
And, continued Commissioner Lin, does not the sanction against your own civilians' use of opium prove that you know full well how harmful it is to mankind? We should like to ask, has China ever sent forth a noxious article from its soil? Have we ever sold you anything save for that which is beneficial, that which your country has great demand for? Is your argument now that the opium trade is, in fact, good for us?
The debate, insisted Mr. Bayliss, is about economics. I once had an admiral seize my ship and search it for opium. When I explained to him I had none, as I follow the laws set by the Qing Emperor, he professed disappointment. He was hoping to purchase it wholesale and redistribute it himself, you see, which proves the Chinese have much to profit from this trade as well.
You're still avoiding the question of who smokes the opium, said Commissioner Lin. Mr. Bayliss gave an exasperated sigh.
Robin, tell him.
I will reiterate to you what we wrote to your Queen Victoria, said Commissioner Lin. Those who wish to trade with our celestial empire must obey the laws set down by the Emperor, and the Emperor's new law, about to be put into force, reads that any foreigners bringing opium into China with designs to sell it will be decapitated, and all property on board the ship will be confiscated.
But you can't do that, Mr. Bayliss blustered. Those are British citizens you're talking about. That's British property.
Not when they chose to be criminals. Here, William Botello mirrored Commissioner Lin's cool disdain with exact precision, down to the slightest arch of his eyebrow. Robin was impressed.
Now look here, said Mr. Bayliss. The British don't fall under your jurisdiction, Commissioner. You haven't got any real authority.
I'm aware that you believe your interests will always supersede our laws, said Commissioner Lin. Yet we stand inside Chinese territory. And so I will remind you, and your masters, that we will enforce our laws as we see fit.
Then you know we'll have to defend our citizens as we see fit.
Robin was so amazed Mr. Bayliss had spoken these words out loud that he forgot to translate. There was an awkward pause. At last, William Botello murmured Mr. Bayliss's meaning in Chinese to Commissioner Lin. Commissioner Lin was utterly unfazed. Is this a threat, Mr. Bayliss? Mr. Bayliss opened his mouth, seemed to think better of it, and then closed it. Irritated as he was, he'd apparently realized that as much as he loved verbally berating the Chinese, he still couldn't issue a declaration of war without his government's backing. All four parties regarded each other in silence. Then, abruptly, Commissioner Lin nodded to Robin. I would like a private conversation with your assistant.
Him? He hasn't any company authority.
Robin translated automatically on Mr. Bayliss's behalf.
He's just the interpreter.
I mean only for a casual conversation, said Commissioner Lin.
But he's not permitted to speak on my behalf.
I don't need him to. In fact,
I rather think we've said all that needs to be said to each other, said Commissioner Lin. Don't you? Robin allowed himself the simple pleasure of watching Mr. Bayliss's shock turn to indignation. He considered translating his stuttered protests, but decided on silence when it became clear none of it was coherent. At last, Mr. Bayliss, for lack of any better option, allowed himself to be escorted out of the room. You too, Commissioner Lin told William Botello, who obeyed without comment. Then they were alone. Commissioner Lin gazed at him for a long, silent moment. Robin blinked, unable to sustain eye contact. He felt certain he was being searched, and this made him feel both inadequate and desperately uncomfortable. What is your name? Commissioner Lin asked quietly. Robin Swift, Robin said, then blinked, confused. The Anglophone name seemed incongruous for a conversation held in Chinese. His other name, his first name, had not been used for so long that it hadn't crossed his mind to say it. I mean, but he was too embarrassed to continue. Commissioner Lin's gaze was curious, unmoving. Where are you from? Here, in fact, said Robin, grateful for a question he could easily answer. Though I left when I was very young, and I haven't been back in a long time. How interesting. Why did you leave? My mother died of cholera, and a professor at Oxford became my guardian. You belong to their school, then? The Translation Institute? I do. It's the reason why I left for England. I've studied my whole life to be a translator. A very honourable profession, said Commissioner Lin. Many of my countrymen look down on learning barbarian tongues. But I've commissioned quite a few translation projects since I assumed power here. You must know the barbarians to control the barbarians, don't you think? Something about the man compelled Robin to speak frankly. That's rather the same attitude they have about you. To his relief, Commissioner Lin laughed. This emboldened Robin. May I ask you something? Go ahead. Why do you call them Yi? She must know that they hate it. But all it means is foreign, said Commissioner Lin. They are the ones who insisted on its connotations. They create the insult for themselves. Then wouldn't it be easier just to say Yang? Would you let someone come in and tell you what words in your own language mean? We have words to use when we wish to insult. They should feel lucky Gui is not more prevalent.
Gui can mean ghost or demon. In this context, it is most commonly translated as foreign devil.
Robin chuckled. Fair enough. Now, I would like you to be frank with me, said Commissioner Lin. Is there any point to negotiating this subject? If we swallowed our pride, if we bent the knee, would this mediate things whatsoever? Robin wanted to say yes. He wished he could claim that yes, of course, there was yet space to negotiate. That Britain and China, both being nations led by rational, enlightened people, could certainly find a middle ground without resorting to hostilities. But he knew this was not true. He knew Bayliss, Jardine and Matheson had no intention of compromising with the Chinese. Compromise required some acknowledgement that the other party deserved equal moral standing. But to the British, he'd learned, the Chinese were like animals. No, he said. They want what they want, and they won't settle for anything less. They don't respect you or your government. Your obstacles to be resolved one way or another. Disappointing, for all their talk of rights and dignity. I think those principles only apply to those they find human. Commissioner Lin nodded. He seemed to have decided something. His features set with resolve. Then there's no need to waste words, is there? Only when Commissioner Lin turned his back to him did Robin realize he had been dismissed. Unsure what to do, he gave an awkward, perfunctory bow and left the room. Mr. Bayliss was waiting in the corridor, looking disgruntled.
Anything?
He demanded as servants escorted them out of the hall. Nothing, Robin said. He felt slightly dizzy. The audience had ended so abruptly that he didn't know what to make of it. He'd been so focused on the mechanics of translation, on conveying Mr. Bayliss's precise meanings, word for word, that he'd failed to grasp the shift in the conversation.
he'd sensed something momentous had just occurred. But he wasn't sure of what, nor his role in it. He kept going over the negotiation in his head, wondering if he'd made some disastrous mistake. But it had all been so civil. They had only reiterated positions well established on paper, had they not? He seemed to have considered the matter settled. Mr. Bayliss hurried immediately to the upstairs offices upon their return to the English factory, leaving Robin alone in the lobby. He wasn't sure what to do with himself. He was supposed to have been out interpreting all afternoon, but Mr. Bayliss had absconded without any parting instructions. He waited in the lobby for a few minutes, then at last made his way to the sitting room, assuming it would be best to stay in a public area in case Mr. Bayliss decided he still needed him. Rami, Letty and Victoire sat at a table, playing a game of cards. Robin took the empty seat beside Rami. "Don't you have silver to polish?"
"Finished early," Rami dealt him a hand. "Gets a bit boring here when you can't speak the language, to be honest. We're thinking we might take a boat trip to see the Far Ti River Gardens later when we're allowed. How was the meeting with the Commissioner?"
"Strange," said Robin. "We didn't get anywhere. He seemed very interested in me, though."
"Because he can't figure out why a Chinese interpreter is working for the enemy?"
"I suppose," Robin said. He couldn't shake a sense of foreboding, as if watching a gathering storm, waiting for the skies to split. The mood in the sitting room seemed too light-hearted, too tranquil. "How are you all? You think they'll give you anything more interesting to do?"
"Not likely," Victoire yawned. "We're abandoned children. Mama and Papa are too busy wrecking economies to deal with us."
"Good Lord!" Suddenly Letty stood. Her eyes were fixed, wide and horrified on the window where she pointed.
"Look! What in God's name?"
A great fire roared on the opposite bank, but the burn they saw when they rushed to the window was a controlled burn. It only seemed catastrophic because of the billowing flames and smoke. When Robin squinted, he saw that the flames were contained at their source to a pile of chests loaded on deep-bellied boats that had been pushed out to the shallows. A few seconds later, he smelled their contents. A sickly, sweet scent carried by wind across the coast through the windows of the English factory. Opium. Commissioner Lin was burning the opium.
"Robin," Professor Lovell stormed into the room, followed closely by Mr. Bayliss. Both looked furious. Professor Lovell's face in particular was twisted with the rage Robin had never seen on him.
"What did you do?"
"I... what?"
Robin looked from Professor Lovell to the window, baffled.
"I don't understand."
"What did you say?"
Professor Lovell repeated, shaking Robin by the collar.
"What did you tell him?"
It was the first time Professor Lovell had laid hands on him since that day in the library. Robin didn't know what Professor Lovell might do now. The look in his eyes was beastly, wholly unrecognizable.
"Please,"
Robin thought wildly.
"Please, hurt me. Hit me, because then we'll know. Then there won't be any question."
But the spell passed as quickly as it came. Professor Lovell let go of Robin, blinking, as if coming back to himself. He took a step back and dusted off the front of his jacket. Around them, Rami and Victoire stood tense, both crouching as if to spring between them.
"Excuse me, I simply..."
Professor Lovell cleared his throat.
"Get your things and meet me outside, all of you. The Hellas is waiting in the bay."
"But aren't we headed to Macau next?"
Letty asked.
"Our notices said..."
"The situation's changed,"
Professor Lovell said curtly.
"We've booked early passage back to England. Go."
Chapter 18. It were too much to expect that they will not require a further demonstration of force on a larger scale before being brought to their senses. James Matheson, letter to John Purvis. The Hellas departed Pearl Bay with impressive haste. Within 15 minutes of their boarding, the ropes were cut, the anchors pulled, and the sails unfurled. They darted out of the harbour, chased by billowing smoke that seemed to engulf the whole of the city.
The crew, who had not been told until boarding that they would be responsible for the room and board of 5 additional passengers, were curt and annoyed. The Hellas was not a passenger ship, and its quarters were already cramped. Rami and Robin were told to bunk with the sailors, but the girls were afforded a private cabin, which they shared with the only other civilian on board, a woman named Jemima Smythe, a Christian missionary from America who tried to sneak into the mainland but was caught trying to ford the river into Canton's suburbs.
"Do you know what all the fuss is?"
she kept asking as they sat haunched together in the mess.
"Was it an accident? Or did the Chinese do it on purpose? Will it be open war now, do you think?"
The last question she kept repeating excitedly at intervals, despite their exasperated assurances that they did not know. At last, she changed the subject to what they'd been doing in Canton, and how they'd passed their days in the English factory.
"There are quite a few reverends under that roof, aren't there? What did you do for your Sunday services?"
She stared inquiringly at Rami.
"Do you go to Sunday services?"
"Of course." Rami did not miss a beat. "I go because I'm forced, where I mumble apologies to Allah whenever possible."
"He's joking,"
Letty said quickly before the horrified Miss Smythe could begin trying to convert him.
"He's Christian, of course. We all had to subscribe to the 39 articles at Oxford matriculation."
This was true, though Rami did so only because he would not have been allowed to matriculate otherwise. Religion had always been a point of contention between the 4 of them. Though they were all mandated by the college to attend Sunday services, only Letty and Victoire did so willingly. Rami, of course, resented every minute, and Robin had been raised by Professor Lovell to be a devout atheist. "Christianity is barbaric," Professor Lovell opined. "It is all self-flagellation, professed repression, and bloody superstitious rituals as dress up for doing whatever one wants. Go to church if they make you, but take it as a chance to practice your recitations under your breath."
"I'm very glad for you," Miss Smythe said sincerely. "Will you be spreading the gospel back home as well?"
"Home is Oxford," Rami said, blinking innocently.
"God help us," thought Robin. He snapped. "Do you mean that Oxford is full of heathens? Good heavens, has anyone told them?"
At last, Miss Smythe grew tired of them and wandered above deck to say her prayers, or whatever it was that missionaries did. Robin, Letty, Rami, and Victoire huddled around the table, fidgeting like naughty schoolchildren awaiting punishment. Professor Lovell was nowhere to be seen. The moment they'd boarded, he'd gone off to speak to the captain. Still, no one had told them what was going on, or what would happen next.
"What did you say to the commissioner?" Victoire asked quietly.
"The truth," said Robin.
"All I told him was the truth."
"But surely something set him off." Professor Lovell appeared at the door. They fell silent.
"Robin," he said, "let's have a chat."
He did not wait for Robin's answer before he turned and headed down the passage. Reluctantly, Robin stood. Rami touched his arm.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine." Robin hoped they could not tell how quickly his heart was beating, or how loudly the blood thundered through his ears. He did not want to follow Professor Lovell. He wanted to hide and stall, to sit in the corner of the mess with his head buried in his arms. But this confrontation had been a long time coming. The fragile truce struck on the morning of his arrest was never sustainable. They'd been lying to themselves for too long, he and his father. Things could not remain buried, hidden, and willfully ignored forever. Sooner or later, things had to come to a head.
"I'm curious."
Professor Lovell was sitting behind a desk, paging idly through a dictionary when Robin at last made his way to his cabin.
"Do you know the value of those chests burned in the harbour?"
Robin stepped inside and closed the door behind him. His knees trembled. He could have been 11 again, caught for reading fiction when he shouldn't have been, cringing from the impending blow. But he was not a child anymore. He tried his very best to keep his voice from wobbling.
"Sir, I don't know what happened with the commissioner, but it's not..."
"Over £2 million, said Professor Lovell. "You heard Mr. Bayliss. £2 million.
much of which William Jardine and James Matheson are now personally responsible for.
He'd made up his mind, said Robin. He'd made it up before he even met with us. There was nothing I could say.
Your job was not difficult. Be a mouthpiece for Harold Bayliss. Present a friendly face to the Chinese. Smooth things over. I thought we were clear on your priorities here, no? What did you say to Commissioner Lin?
I don't know what you think I did, said Robin, frustrated. But what happened at the docks wasn't because of me.
Did you suggest he should destroy the opium?
Of course not.
Did you intimate anything else to him about Jardine and Matheson? Did you perhaps usurp Harold in any way? You sure there was nothing untoward about how you conducted yourself?
I did what I was told, Robin insisted. I don't like Mr. Bayliss, no. But as far as how I represented the company...
For once, Robin, please try to simply say what you mean, said Professor Lovell. Be honest. Whatever you're doing now, it's embarrassing.
All right, then.
Robin folded his arms.
He had nothing to apologize for. Nothing more to hide. Rami and Victoire were safe. He had nothing to lose. No more bowing. No more silence.
Fine. Let's be honest with each other.
I don't agree with what Jardine and Matheson is doing in Canton. It's wrong. It disgusts me.
Professor Lovell shook his head.
For heaven's sake, it's just a market. Don't be childish.
It's a sovereign nation.
It's a nation mired in superstition and antiquity, devoid of the rule of law, hopelessly behind the West in every possible register. It is a nation of semi-barbarous, incorrigibly backwards fools.
It's a nation of people, Robin snapped. People you're poisoning, whose lives you're ruining. And if the question is whether I'll keep facilitating that project, then it's no, I won't come back to Canton again. Not for the traders, and not for anything remotely related to opium. I'll do research at Babel, I'll do translations, but I won't do that. You can't make me.
He was breathing very hard when he finished. Professor Lovell's expression had not changed. He watched Robin for a long moment, eyelids half closed, tapping his fingers against his desk as if it were a piano.
You know what astounds me?
His voice had grown very soft.
How utterly ungrateful one can be.
This line of argument again. Robin could have kicked something. Always this. The argument from bondage, as if his loyalties were shackled by privilege he had not asked for and did not choose to receive. Did he owe Oxford his life just because he had drunk champagne within its cloisters? Did he owe Babel his loyalty because he had once believed its lies?
This wasn't for me, he said. I didn't ask for it. It was all for you. Because you wanted a Chinese pupil. Because you wanted someone who was fluent.
You resent me, then? Asked Professor Lovell. For giving you a life. For giving you opportunities you couldn't have dreamed of.
He sneered.
Yes, Robin, I took you from your home. From the squalor and disease and hunger. What do you want? An apology?
What he wanted, Robin thought, was for Professor Lovell to admit what he'd done. That it was unnatural, this entire arrangement. That children were not stock to be experimented on. Judged for their blood, spirited away from their homeland in service of crown and country. That Robin was more than a talking dictionary, and that his motherland was more than a fat golden goose. But he knew these were acknowledgements that Professor Lovell would never make. The truth between them was not buried because it was painful, but because it was inconvenient, and because Professor Lovell simply refused to address it. It was so obvious now that he was not, and could never be, a person in his father's eyes. No, personhood demanded the blood purity of the European man, the racial status that would make him Professor Lovell's equal. Little Dick and Philippa were persons. Robin Swift was an asset, and assets should be undyingly grateful that they were treated well at all. There could be no resolution here, but at least Robin would have the truth about something.
Who was my mother to you?
He asked. This, at least, seemed to rattle the professor, if only for the briefest moment.
We're not here to discuss your mother.
You killed her, and you didn't even bother to bury her.
Don't be absurd, it was the Asiatic cholera that killed her.
You were in Macau for 2 weeks before she died. Mrs. Piper told me. You knew the plague was spreading. You knew you could have saved her. Heavens, Robin, she was just some chink. But I'm just some chink, Professor. I'm also her son.
Robin felt a fierce urge to cry. He forced it down. Hurt never garnered sympathy from his father. But anger, perhaps, might spark fear. Did you think you'd wash that part out of me? He had become so good at holding two truths in his head at once. That he was an Englishman and not. That Professor Lovell was his father and not. That the Chinese were a stupid, backwards people, and that he was also one of them. That he hated Babel and wanted to live forever in its embrace. He had danced for years on the razor's edge of these truths, had remained there as a means of survival, a way to cope, unable to accept either side fully, because an unflinching examination of the truth was so frightening that the contradictions threatened to break him. But he could not go on like this. He could not exist a split man, his psyche constantly erasing and re-erasing the truth. He felt a great pressure in the back of his mind. He felt like he would quite literally burst unless he stopped being double. Unless he chose. "Did you think," said Robin, "that enough time in England would make me just like you?" Professor Lovell cocked his head. "You know, I once thought that having offspring was a kind of translation of its own. Especially when the parents are of such vastly different stock. One is curious to see what ends up coming through." His face underwent the strangest transformation as he spoke. His eyes grew larger and larger until they were frighteningly bulbous. His condescending sneer grew more pronounced, and his lips drew back to reveal teeth. It was meant, perhaps, as a look of exaggerated disgust, but it appeared more to Robin as if a mask of civility had been stripped away. It was the ugliest expression he had ever seen his father wear. "I'd hoped to raise you to avoid the failings of your brother. I hope to instill you with a more civilized sense of ethics. Quo semel est imputa recens. Serve a bit odorem testa diu," and all that.
Horace, on the education of youths to ward off corruption. A cask will long retain the flavour of that with which it was first filled.
"I hoped I might develop you into a more elevated cask. But for all your education, there's no raising you from that base original stock, is there?"
"You're a monster," Robin said, amazed.
"I haven't the time for this." Professor Lovell flipped the dictionary shut. "It's clear bringing you to Canton was the wrong idea. I had hoped it might remind you how lucky you are, but all it's done is confuse you."
"I'm not confused.
We'll reevaluate your position at Babel when we return." Professor Lovell gestured towards the door. "For now, I think you ought to take some time to reflect. Imagine spending the rest of your life in Newgate, Robin. You can rail against the evils of commerce all you like if you do it in a prison cell. Would you prefer that?" Robin's hands formed fists.
"Say her name."
Professor Lovell's eyebrow twitched. He gestured again to the door. "That will be all."
"Say her name, you coward. Robin."
This was a warning. This was where his father drew the line. Everything Robin had done until now might still be forgiven, if he only backed down. If he only made his apologies, bent to authority and returned to naive, ignorant luxury. But Robin had been bending for so long, and even a gilded cage was still a cage. He stepped forward.
"Father, say her name."
Professor Lovell pushed his chair back and stood. The origins of the word anger were tied closely to physical suffering. Anger was first an affliction, as meant by the old Icelandic angr, and then a painful, cruel, narrow state, as meant by the old English enger, which in turn came from the Latin angor, which meant strangling, anguish, distress. Anger was a chokehold. Anger did not empower you. It sat on your chest. It squeezed your ribs until you felt trapped, suffocated, out of options. Anger simmered, then exploded. Anger was constriction, and the consequent rage, a desperate attempt to breathe. And rage, of course, came from madness.
From the Latin rabere, to rave, to be mad.
Afterwards, Robin wondered often if Professor Lovell had seen something in his eyes, a fire he hadn't known his son possessed, and whether that, his startled realization that his linguistic experiment had developed a will of his own, had prompted Robin